Now that we have considered a number of precursors to the Protestant Reformation, it is time for us to look at the birth of the Reformation itself. And in the view of most church historians, it is simply not possible to examine the birth of the Reformation without also examining the life of one man whose name is almost synonymous with the phrase Protestant Reformation, and that man is Martin Luther. Because Martin Luther, while not the first man to speak out against the errors and abuses of the Roman Catholic Church, was the one that God used to sound the rallying trumpet for Reformation. And the sound of his trumpet blast would reach the furthest ends of the Western world and would echo in the ears of biblically minded Christians who were committed to reform for many centuries to follow. And so Martin Luther was a key figure in the Protestant Reformation. He deserves to be known by all who long for the truth and for the good of God's church on earth. And who was Martin Luther? And how did God use him in the cause of Reformation? Well, for the next few weeks, Lord willing, we will examine the life of Martin Luther and his role in the Reformation. And as we do, I trust that our knowledge and appreciation of Luther will grow, as well as our gratitude to God for his goodness in raising up Martin Luther and like men and bringing about this glorious revival in the church that we refer to today as the Protestant Reformation. Now, before we begin, for those of you who might want to do some further reading and studying on Luther and his role in the Reformation, the first book I'd like to recommend to you is entitled Martin Luther, A Guided Tour of His Life and Thought. And this book was written by Stephen J. Nichols and is published by P&R Publishing Company. And I recommend this, first of all, because this book is an excellent introduction to the life of Martin Luther, his various works and contributions. And I think it will be a great place for anyone to start in their studies on Luther's life. Then I'd also like to recommend a book that really is a classic biography on Luther, and it's entitled Here I Stand, A Life of Martin Luther by Roland Bainton. And this book is a little dated. In fact, it's been in circulation for many, many years. And there are more recent biographies that I think are a little more comprehensive. But I would recommend this work. As I said, it's a classic, and it's a classic for a reason. And I think many of you would enjoy reading it. It's published by Abingdon Press. And let me also recommend a book entitled Luther the Reformer, The Story of the Man and His Career. And the author's name is James Kittleson, and the publisher is Fortress Press. And then lastly, for those of you who are really serious about studies on the life of Luther, I would recommend to you this afternoon The Cambridge Companion to Martin Luther. The Cambridge Companion to Martin Luther is edited by Donald K. McKim, and it is published by Cambridge University Press. And what is really good about this particular work is that it contains not only biographical material about Luther and his life, but many essays on various historical aspects surrounding Luther's life and the many of the forces which were at work prior to and during the early days of the Reformation. So it provides a very fascinating historical context as well as details about Luther's life. And it is a little scholarly, but I think it's worth a careful study for those of you who want to know more about Luther and this period. But now let's begin our own study of Luther by considering first his birth and early years. Martin Luther was born to his parents, John and Margaret Luther, or to use their German names, Hans and Marguerite Luder, L-U-D-E-R. I have it written on the board here for you. In fact, the name Luther is actually the Latinized spelling of the German name Luder. Martin Luther was born to John and Margaret Luther on November 10th, 1483, in Saxony, Germany. This was 99 years after Wycliffe's death, 68 years after Huss's death, and 15 years before Savonarola's death. So that gives you kind of a historical framework to consider when you look at this date of Martin Luther's birth. The day after Luther's birth, he was baptized. He was given the name Martin after the Roman Catholic saint of that same day, Saint Martin. And this was not an uncommon practice at that particular time. Children were brought to church to be baptized the day after their birth, and whatever day that was, there would be a corresponding Roman Catholic saint, and it was very common, particularly with male children, to name the children after the patron saint for that particular day. Luther's parents, John and Margaret, were of humble peasant origins. In fact, Luther would later describe himself as a tough Saxon of peasant blood. Now, some people laugh and say that he always used this as an excuse for his behavior. He would always say, "I want to remind you that I grew up as a peasant in tough Saxony." But the truth of the matter is, Luther was very proud of his heritage. Luther's parents were by no means, however, uneducated pagans. Although from a farming family, John Luther had a more cultivated mind than most people. And he read a great deal. In fact, John Luther loved books and took every opportunity he had to obtain them. Luther's mother, on the other hand, probably could not read. In fact, we take it for granted in our society that boys and girls are educated and can read at a relatively early age. But in that day, it was not common for women to be able to read. Men who had been educated could often read. Many peasants could not, so John Luther, in that sense, had been privileged. But again, many women could not read in that day. But she was known as a good and pious woman and mother. In fact, Martin Luther would look back fondly on her godly influence in his life. Shortly after Luther was born, his parents moved to Mansfield, in the heart of Germany's mining industry, and Luther's father worked as a miner. They were very poor during these years and struggled a great deal to survive. But Luther's parents worked hard to establish a good home for their son and for his siblings to follow. In fact, Luther was the eldest of probably 9 sisters and brothers. Now, there is some debate as to whether it was 8 sisters and brothers or 9 sisters and brothers, but and needless to say, in either case, it was a large family. And you could imagine the expense of raising that many children on such a small income. And in Mansfield, Luther, who was a bright and in some ways a mischievous child, had a relatively normal childhood for that day. Now, it was well known that Luther's father was very stern with him, and that his parents were very strict in their discipline of him. Luther once wrote, "My parents treated me harshly. so that I became very timid. My mother one day chastised me so severely for stealing a hazelnut that the blood came. They seriously thought that they were doing right, that they could not distinguish character, which, however, is very necessary in order to know when or where or how chastisement should be inflicted. It is necessary to punish, but the apple should be placed beside the rod. And as we might expect, some contemporary biographers of Luther, thinking along the lines of modern psychology, have suggested that this harsh treatment from his parents adversely affected Luther's personality and made him withdrawn and depressive, and some have even suggested somewhat emotionally imbalanced. And some have gone as far as to suggest that maybe this treatment as a child also caused him to act as he did later in life. And people who say this are normally critical of Luther and think that he was a rebel, and so he was reacting even in later life to some of the mistreatment that he received in his childhood. But of course, this is mere conjecture, and it cannot be substantiated. Partly because Luther only made a relatively small number of statements about his childhood and what he did say about his parents' treatment of him in this regard has to be balanced against all the other positive statements that he made later in life about his father's and mother's influence upon him as a young child. Now, at this point, does anybody have any questions or comments that they'd like to make before we move on to the latter stages of Luther's childhood and life? Yes, him. Right, so your comment is, some have been critical about the treatment that Luther received from his parents and have sought to point to that as a cause for some of the things that he experienced in later life. But your point is, Luther has shown himself to be somewhat of a critical individual in regards to himself, certainly very self-disciplined, serious-minded and sober, even at a relatively young age. Yes, yes. That's not to say that his parents didn't have an influence on him, and a profound influence. But there were certainly characteristics in Luther's personality, even at a young age, through no doubt DNA, that determined much of how Luther would respond to his environment even at a young age, and no doubt he was acting consistent with that throughout his childhood and later life. And so I don't think we can blame everything that Luther did negatively in his childhood and later life upon his parents and the way they approached the discipline of their children. To be honest with you, parents tend to be very stern and strict with discipline in that day. And that's why I used the words earlier when describing his childhood as a relatively normal childhood for that day. I don't think that Luther's parents were particularly tyrannical in comparison to other parents at that particular day. That was simply the means that parents used to guide and correct their children. And the fact that Luther later on would say some things about that and view it a little harshly doesn't necessarily mean that it was in any way abusive. Yes, point. There have been contemporary biographers and historians that have tried to fixate on Luther's quote-unquote self-hatred and have sought to find the source of this. It's abnormal, it was unhealthy, where was it derived from? And again, they go back to statements like this from Luther, which I don't think Luther intended to suggest that his parents were in any sense abusive. But they do go back to statements like this from Luther, saying the kid must have had a horrible childhood, and as a result, he probably spent his evenings hiding in the closet and, you know, listening for the footsteps of his father and, you know, that type of thing. And there's absolutely no historical evidence to support that. And as we'll see, as we continue in the life of Luther, when Luther is going through what we might describe as some of his more morbid periods of self-examination, periods when he did, in fact, loathe himself, he never seems to indicate that those periods were a result of his childhood. No, he was wrestling with something entirely different. He was wrestling with a spiritual crisis that had nothing to do with his physical upbringing in the sense that we're discussing it now. But those are excellent points. Any other comments before we go into this? And you know, yes, how much of it is spiritual and how much of it is it his personality or his disposition? Well, we're going to get into more detail later.
They didn't have the medicine to take care of it at this time.
Right.
In his day and age. Like they do now in the 21st century. I have an older son who has schizophrenia.
Right.
And now with all the things that they have to help him, it is so much better now.
Well, I think we have to be careful in wanting to diagnose Brother Luther, because again, we have limited statements, and I think people have a tendency to generalize in some ways because a person goes through an intense spiritual struggle, an intense time of morbid self-examination, a time of great uncertainty, certainly similar in characteristic of depression, wrestling with peace, having no sense of assurance. That doesn't necessarily mean that that individual has a major depressive disorder. There certainly are personalities that do show characteristics of that, and I think on close examination, you know, we might be able to determine that that person would have chemical problems or other physical problems that would lend to that. The problem is we just don't know that about Luther. Okay? By all accounts, I think Luther had a relatively peaceful and joyous childhood. It's just that there were certain events in his life that took place. And we see his introspection and his depressive characteristics, I think, later on when he's not so much dealing with physical issues, but rather when he's dealing with spiritual turmoil. Now, I'm just saying that because I don't want us to leap to conclusions here and try to put Luther in some kind of box and say, okay, you know, Luther had this kind of temperament and Luther had this kind of defect, and in some ways those were working against him. I don't want to go that far simply because I don't think we have the license and liberty to do that. I think we just have to recognize that these were the struggles that he did have. And the only reason I mention this thing from his childhood is because some people in contemporary writings, with, again, the mindset of modern psychology, have tried to psychoanalyze Luther.
Yeah.
Yes?
In the secret of Luther framing this the wrong way, and looking at the diagnostic interest, we know biblically that men of Catholic have shown the cause of these sorts of things. It matters not what the condition is. Joseph, who is a slave, put in the whole body, so other ends up with his second command.
Right.
So, some folks don't think about what he had, but what and whom God used to create a church that would be coming back to this principle.
Right.
So, that's how he's focused, that it doesn't matter about this specific diagnosis.
I think you bring an excellent point. Really, the focus should not be on this is what Luther experienced and look at the difficulties that he had, but really the focus should be look at the grace of God. Now, look at the grace of God at work in Luther's life. And certainly he had struggles in his life. as we all have struggles. But by the grace of God, Luther eventually found peace in Christ. And, you know, later on, when he is a man confident of his salvation and confident of the call of God, we don't see as many of these issues in his life as we did prior to his conversion. Yes?
I was going to say, spiritual realization of your position in relation to a holy God can cause a lot of physical, emotional disruption.
Yeah,
I mean, it does affect a person.
Sure.
And you can look at that person and say, well, you're crazy, but really, no, they are wrestling with strong spiritual truth.
That's right.
And it does affect someone. We keep up at night, it just makes them really struggle.
That's an excellent point, because as we look at the lives of many of the saints throughout church history, we do see accounts of people engaged in serious soul struggle with the matter of their own salvation and going through great periods of restlessness and depression and uncertainty and the inability to look beyond themselves and to look at Christ. And we could argue that those are all characteristic of an individual who is without Christ and an individual who is experiencing conviction. Yes?
It might be a sign that someone is actually becoming sane.
Right. It certainly could be a promising sign that God is at work. He is working that grace which precedes saving grace, so to speak. He's working in their hearts to bring them to the point of realization that they're in need of a Savior. Yes, Rob, did you have enough? It's an excellent point, because if we were to look at the medieval church and people who were raised within the medieval church in that day, you know, they were driven by fear for the most part. I mean, they were always concerned that they were not doing enough to win God's favor. They were responding not with hearts of gratitude to God for what he had done, but out of fear that God would torment them, literally torment them and cast them into hell without so much as a consideration for them. And I think that was partly due to the fact that God was presented in that way to many. As we'll read, or as you'll hear in a short time from now, you know, Luther's initial images of Christ, you know, were not as a loving shepherd or as the savior of sinners. I mean, Luther's initial images of Christ was Christ as judge. And when you only know Christ as judge, even from a young person, and you're well aware of the fact that you cannot stand before that judge in your own righteousness, that doesn't paint a very encouraging picture for you to live by. Yes, Jeff?
It sounds kind of like what happens now, in that that's why a lot of Roman Catholics will try to get to Christ through Mary.
Right. Well, yeah, you're right. You're right. That is one of the reasons why Mariology really became very popular, because Christ was the judge, the stern judge. And Mary, on the other hand, his mother, was the loving mother. Yeah, everybody loves a mother. So, you know, you would go to Jesus, and Jesus is the stern judge. He's ready to judge you. But you could go to Mary, and Mary is the loving, compassionate mother, right? And some authors during that time were even bold enough as to say that you could go to Christ, and Christ would be angry, but you could ask his mother to go to him, and his mother would actually go and intercede for you and calm her son down and, you know, win an audience or win acceptance for you. I mean, literally, that's the way people thought. So, you know, all of these are factors that have to be considered. This has been a good discussion, but I think we have to be gracious with Luther as we're evaluating him at this period. But at the same time, we need to recognize some of the early influences upon him. Now, in regards to what we were saying earlier about the treatment of his parents and whether or not that adversity affected him, I think I agree with N.R. Needham in his book, 2,000 Years of Christ's Power, Part 3, that the most we can safely say about this is that there was some emotional tension between a stern father and a sensitive son. And that tension may have intensified young Luther's insecurity and may have affected, in some sense, his quest for the assurance of salvation. That's the most we can say. And no doubt one of the reasons for his father's sternness was his determination to see his son Martin well-educated and better off than himself. And Martin received a good childhood education in Mansfield, where he studied Latin, elementary grammar, and the essentials of the Christian religion. And then Luther was sent by his parents at age 14 to continue his education at the monastery in Magdeburg. And this monastery was run by an order known as the Brethren of the Common Life. And what's really interesting is that this was the same monastic order that Erasmus had been exposed to. And you'll remember from our study of Erasmus that he did not think back very pleasantly upon his experience in the monastery and was later critical of monastic life. But interesting, in the providence of God, Luther now is in this monastery run by the Brethren of the Common Life, and these brethren were known for their intense piety. However, the education at this monastery was also very expensive. And since his family could not pay for all of his educational costs, Luther often took to the streets of the city, begging and saying, "Panem propter diem," which simply means "bread for God's sake." So you get a sense here of how poor he was as a student, how modest his means were, even for the purposes of his own education. A year later, through some unexpected assistance from his mother's family, Luther was able to transfer to the parish school at St. George's in Eisenach. This school had appealed to Luther for academic as well as financial reasons. And while there, Luther excelled in his studies and even rose to first in his class. So you see here a lot of movement. He's in one place and then he's transferred to another that provides a little bit better education. You can see here there's this attempt on the part of Luther and his family to get the very best education he can possibly get. And he goes to this parish school at St. George's in Eisenach. It was in Eisenach that Luther also developed his love for poetry and for music. And of course, these loves, especially for music, would continue all throughout Luther's life. In fact, later in life, Luther was quoted as saying, "After theology, I accord music the highest place and the greatest honor." Some of you who love music can appreciate what Luther is saying and certainly agree with his sympathies. But I believe it was R.C. Sproul who suggested that if Luther had not been a reformer, he might well have become one of the greatest musicians of the church. His love for music was that great. And of course, you know, we sing hymns that were composed by Luther. Of course, the most famous being, "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God." So we get a sense of the enjoyment that Luther must have received from music and his desire to express the truth of God through music as well. So Luther benefited from his time in the parish school there although he would later complain that the education that he had received there in the monastery had also been far too rigid. And I won't go into a lot of detail about that, but it was very strict in its discipline, very strict in its administration, and it wasn't the best environment maybe for a young person who wanted to enjoy some of the more relaxing aspects of life. In the school at the monastery. When he is sent to the monastery in Magdeburg, and it is a year later that he transfers to the parish school at St. George's in Eisenach. So that makes Luther roughly about 15 years old.
And the reason I believe this book is beside comment, you talk about sturdiness, but we're talking about a 16-year-old who is probably writing prolifically, thinking analytically, logically, spiritually. Look at our 15 years. Go around and look at your...
Look at your average 15-year-old. Yeah, absolutely.
15-year-old, just to see what the difference is. And it also happens in America, by the way, during the colonial time. There were 15 and 16-year-olds who were writing multi-volume works.
Yeah, Luther, no doubt by this time, was proficient in many disciplines that we would consider to be probably college-level academics. Proficient, no doubt, in Latin, and probably Greek to a large extent, mathematics, geometry, astronomy. I mean, he is well able to express himself. And he is able to read and to interact with a lot of sources that are only available to those who have studied hard and experienced a disciplined pattern of education.
But I'm going to have the music thing.
Yes, the music thing.
Grace music second to
Grace music second to theology.
And I've heard and realized that the reason why he says this is because he sees a parallel between Ignatius and Augustine. There's a real emphasis on the outward effect and the inward. That's the same way as the gospel comes through the ear gate, music comes through the ear gate.
Yes.
That's
right. Luther believed in the power of music to affect the soul. Yeah. And that's why it was a passion to him. And to be honest with you, a lot of it had to do with his humble origins as well. You know, the people in Germany loved music. We would characterize it today as folk music. It was very popular. And he grew up with music and loved music. And was inclined toward the practice of music. And that love for music continued. And of course, as he continued to mature, and as his views became more Christianized, if I can say that, then he began to love the music of the church also. And there's no question that music performed well can do the soul great good. I mean, we're all familiar with the shepherd boy David and his remarkable ability to play music that even soothed the troubled soul of King Saul. So, yeah, music is powerful. And Luther certainly recognized that. But I think it is important, on the flip side, to realize that Luther knew that theology was first. And would say that music is subservient to good theology. And certainly when we look at the hymns of Luther later on in life, we see that they are hymns that have solid theological foundations. But I think we need to remember that Luther did love music, and that it was always an important thing in his life. Then as a result of his academic performance at the parish school at St. George's in Eisenach, Luther was allowed admission into the University of Erfurt in central Germany. And brother, you asked the question a few moments ago, how old was he? Well, you know, Luther's probably 16 years old when he enters into the university. And that is not uncommon. We don't have 16-year-olds entering into universities today. I guess exceptionally bright 16-year-olds could, but in that day it was not uncommon. for young men to enter into university life at that age. Now, Luther's desire at that time was to finish his university education so that he could fulfill his father's one wish. And that was that Martin enter into the field of law. Martin was determined to make his father pleased in that way. And while at the university, Martin was a very diligent student and very quickly distinguished himself as a young scholar of promise. But at that same time, Luther began to be tormented spiritually. Again, remember how old he is, and remember where he's at when this spiritual torment begins. For example, Stephen J. Nichols, in his book, Martin Luther, A Guided Tour of His Life and Thought, writes this: studying at Erfurt was a turning point in Luther's life on many levels. On his daily walk, Luther encountered a sculpture that often captured his thoughts. The image depicted on the sculpture was Christ as judge, with a sword clenched between his teeth and a piercing snare. This image would haunt Luther for years as he contemplated his guilt before God. So here we see this promising young man there at the university with these academic goals and this desire to please his father, to prepare for the study of law. And while he's involved in this campus life, there are things going on within his own soul that are causing him distress. And here, just this statue of Christ as judge that he passes by each day on his daily walk is used by God to speak to Luther's heart about his own unpreparedness to stand before Jesus Christ as judge. And as Nichols says here, it would haunt Luther for many years. I guess that visual image of that statue would vividly come back to Luther's mind again and again and again whenever he thought of Christ. Imagine that, if your thoughts of Christ were thoughts of Christ with a sword clenched in his teeth. Imagine that would provide you with no comfort whatsoever with it. And yet that is the image that apparently Luther carried within his mind for much of his time. Yet despite these struggles, Luther graduated with a bachelor's degree in 1502, and then a master's degree in 1505, where Luther graduated second out of 17 candidates. So he was right near the top of his class in his graduation from the university with his master's degree. Luther's immediate plans were to remain in Erfurt and to obtain his specialized training in law, because the educational system then was very similar to our educational system now. You would go and you would get your undergraduate degree. In this case, he'd go on to get a master's degree, probably with an additional year or two of study, and then you would go into your specialty, the area of your profession. In this case, with Luther, it would be law. So everything seemed to be going as planned for young Martin. He appeared to be well on his way to achieving his goals. But God, in his most wise and holy providence, had different plans for Martin Luther. And these plans began to unfold in ways that Martin could not have possibly dreamed of. For one day in July 2nd, 1505 to be exact, Martin was returning to Erfurt after a visit to Mansfield. Remember, Mansfield is his boyhood home. While he's returning to Erfurt, he is suddenly caught in a violent thunderstorm and almost hit by a lightning strike. And young Martin was terrified, and understandably so. In fact, I don't know how many of you have ever been in a situation where you have found yourself in an open field, for example, in the middle of a lightning storm, and to hear the thunder and to watch the lightning strike and to have it strike close, and apparently in this case very close to where Luther's almost hit. He is absolutely terrified. But even more so, because this incident brought to his mind like a flood all of his fears about God's judgment and about his own guilt before God. And he was certain that all of this was providential. He was certain that God was displeased. He was certain that his end was at hand. Now, we are getting a little ahead of ourselves, but I found it interesting in listening to a sermon on Martin Luther by Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones within the past week or so, that Martin Lloyd-Jones refers to this incident as the beginning of the Reformation. And he says the Reformation began with a lightning strike. And that was an interesting way to put it, because this lightning strike had a profound effect on Luther. He was certain he would die. And thus, Luther cried out to the one saint that he thought might save him from his distress. And does anybody know who that saint was? Yes, Rob. Saint Anna. Yes, Saint Anna. Now, in some literature, she's referred to as Saint Anne, but really the way that we should refer to it is Saint Anna. And is anybody curious as to why he would cry out to Saint Anna of all the saints that he could have cried out to? Any ideas or guesses? This is a little bit of trivia, but I thought you might find it enlightening. Yes. Protector of travelers? No, that's Saint Christopher. No, Saint Anna is the patron saint of miners. And what did Luther's father do as a profession? He was a miner. And so as a young man, he was no doubt familiar with Saint Anna. And it's very, very possible that in their home, and as a young boy, he prayed to Saint Anna, who was the patron saint of miners, quite often. And specifically, Luther cried out, "Help me, Saint Anna, I will become a monk." And in God's providence, Luther did survive that incident. And he determined that very moment that he would fulfill his vow. Now, it would seem that many are under the impression that Luther simply got off the ground that very day and joined a monastery. But this is not the case. First, Luther had to decide which order he would join. And he chose to join one of the strictest orders of that day, the Augustinian friars, who were hermits and lived very structured and rigorous and regulated lives. And I'd like to pose the question to you this afternoon. Why would he pick one of the strictest orders of that day to join? Rob?
Well, kind of going back to the sudden death of Martin Luther, he experienced this great fear. At
yes.
At that time, in the New Ages, the greatest fear he would have would be sudden death. So what he was experiencing was a very common fear that everybody had, because, you know, the whole Catholic sacramentology was set up to you didn't know if you died suddenly, you wouldn't be able to die in grace.
That's right. You couldn't have last rites if you died suddenly. Right.
And if you had confession the week before, and between your sudden death, you weren't able to, number one, complete your penance. And sometimes the penance would be over the month for you. So some people would have to actually save up enough money so that they could actually carry out the penance. Which means how long, like 3, 4, 5, 6 months, a year, you could die. And so Luther, theoretically, or actually, subtly decides to do the penance itself.
Yes.
All in theology is going to die.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. That's exactly what's going on in Martin's life. Of all the things he could do, he says, I will become a monk. Yeah, because he is thinking about the fact that he would die suddenly. He might die without grace. He would not receive last rites. And that many times in situations like that, they would tell young men to go serve in a monastery. So Luther is going to serve a penance.
Right.
He's going, he's voluntarily going. Nobody's having to tell him. He's not going into the confessional and being told, you need to go into the monastery. He's doing it on his own. Appreciate that input. That's true. And he joins the strictest order. And why the strictest order, do you think? I mean, certainly there were other orders that he could join. Why that particular one? Now, some of you might be thinking, well, because it was Augustinian, and he's an Augustinian at this particular time, but to be honest with you, there's really no evidence at this particular time that he's a convinced Augustinian. Later on, he becomes a convinced Augustinian, but he's not a convinced Augustinian. So why this order? Yes, Jeff.
I don't think I can articulate this very well, but if he's feeling unworthy, he really needs to go to a place that's very strict.
Right, he's feeling unworthy, yes.
Get that unworthiness out.
Right.
Deal with it. Beat it out of him. Do whatever it takes.
Exactly.
Get it out.
That's right. You're right. Because Martin knows, I'm filthy and I'm undone. And if I'm going to go to the monastery, I might as well go to a place that will require of me the very worst, where I will have to face the most difficult circumstances. And there may have been this faint idea in his mind that he deserved it, and that maybe by doing that he could somehow win favor, that God would look upon him favorably because he chose the hardest path as opposed to the easiest path. And that's very, very consistent with medieval thinking at that particular time. Yes, did you have a comment, Rob?
I was going to say there's two medieval systems, two types of clergy. There's the secular.
Right.
And then there's the regular. And the secular clergy are the priests who work among the people. The secular is the regular, which means rule for your monks and the friars.
Right.
And they submit to authority because they're the head of the order. And just as you just said, Martin Luther's theology at that time, the well-being, to such an extent that the best thing you can do to achieve justification is to root out as your sinner.
Right.
Number one. Number two, don't even wish for grace upon yourself, because it's better for you to root out as your sinner than you deserve damnation. And so, if you pray for grace, you're actually sinning, since everything you do is selfish.
Right.
You use the word turn inward, because they don't have a word for that in life. You turn inward. So even praying is sin. So don't even pray for this. So this is all sort of part of this mentality of this, that you will actually be justified by justifying God's pronouncement on you.
Right.
When you justify His pronouncement on you, He justifies you.
Yeah, good point. It's important to understand what Luther's thinking is as he's making this decision and you're into the monastery. And you're right. His understanding of justification at this time is very medieval and very Catholic. And he's thinking that the way that he can be justified is to simply agree with God's justice. That he is unworthy, that he is condemned. And there is a sense in which he does not pray for grace, because he does feel that to pray for grace would be inherently selfish. You can see how he's boxed in here. It's a horrible place to be at. And Luther is compelled to think, well, then I need to bring upon myself what I rightly deserve. the rigors of the strictest order that I can possibly join. And you're right, he's not becoming a common priest among the people. He's serving in the monastery. And it was generally viewed differently in that day than the way people view monasteries today. When people think about monks in monasteries making bread and wine and going barefoot through the garden, you know, and planting flowers and things like that, you know, that's really not the image of the monasteries in that day. Cold, dank, not good places to live and to dwell. Many times the relationship between the brothers in these orders would be very strained. There was a lot of immoral lifestyles. They were not good places to be. It's almost as though he's inflicting upon himself a prison sentence of sorts. Yeah. I think that's a better way to think about it.
It's almost like a distortion of doctrine of grace.
Right.
The legion working through the name so they would believe that. Whereas this was almost a self-masochistic, basically, method of getting grace.
Right.
So, which is, again, the remnant to you is just be good and you can work your way in. But to me, it's just a distortion of that, but he is
grace. Yeah, it's all consistent with the medieval theology of that day. I don't think Luther was alone in this thinking. But again, Luther is being compelled to do these things because he sees Christ as judge. Because he knows that there's no way that he can please God. His views of justification, which we talked about a few moments ago, are certainly not scriptural. And he thinks that this is really the only thing he can do at this point. Other than just crawl up in a ball to move forward in hopes of somehow coming to a place to where he could conceivably find the smile of God. Yeah, even to the Augustinians, Luther becomes an oddity, and they are concerned about him. Because the bottom line is, and we'll get to this, Luther does not find any peace through this process. In fact, it just intensifies. So, the fruit of that type of approach becomes very evident in Luther's life in short order. So as we said, Luther had to decide which order that he would join, and he chose the strictest of that day, the Augustinian friars. Then second, Luther had to submit to a mandatory 15-day waiting period before he could enter the order. And during that time, Luther could have changed his mind and reversed his decision. Right? It was very common for orders to have this 15-day waiting period just to allow for people who might have had purely emotional decisions, who might have been led at one particular moment to decide to join the order, and then, you know, 5 days later, a week later, they say, well, wait a minute, you know, I was just moved by fear or whatever, and I don't think that's my vocation. And they could get out of that during that waiting period. In fact, Luther could have changed his mind and got out of it if it would have been purely an emotional decision. But Luther was resolved to follow through with his commitment. So Luther waits his mandatory waiting period. And after his mandatory waiting period, Luther, in the words of Stephen Nichols, threw a party for his classmates, gave them his law books and his master's cap, and took that step that would radically change his life and change the direction of his life forever. Now, did you have a comment, Ross?
I was kind of finding this sort of like, you know, 15 days, you know, my suddenly coming to the real thing. What? I'm winning here?
Right, in 15 days, you suddenly come to your senses and realize that maybe that's not the best thing to do. And to be honest with you, that must have happened, or they wouldn't have had that waiting period.
I think it was pretty common for 60 years.
Yeah, some had 60.
6 months.
Yeah, some would have extended periods. Sometimes it would be months. Now, as I'll talk about in the second hour, he was also on probation for a year. That may be what you're thinking about as well. Yeah, he was a novice and on probation for the first year in the monastery. We'll talk about that. But there's also this waiting period before he can even enter into the monastery as a novice. Yes. Okay? And he's in between his master's degree in law school when the incident involving the lightning strike happens. So, yeah, he's probably in his early 20s when this is taking place. He's still a relatively young man. Now, Luther decides he's going to take this step that would radically change his life. And Luther actually hopes that he can obtain his father's blessing on his decision to trade a master's cap for a monk's tunic. But that was not to be. Because John or Hans Luther was not happy with his son's decision to become a monk. In fact, Luther would later write, "When I became a monk, my father almost went out of his mind. He was all upset and refused to give me his permission." And so without the support of his father, still wrestling with the pains of his own guilty conscience, Martin Luther enters into monastic service. Before we look at what he experienced at this vital phase in his life. Yeah, with his earthly father's disapproval, that certainly does compound Luther's dilemma. I mean, he certainly does not feel that he has the approval and the pleasure of God on his life, and here at the same time he doesn't have the approval or the permission of his earthly father to pursue this. And probably in Luther's mind, he's probably thinking, of all the professions that my father would probably be most proud of would be a profession in the service of the church. But that's certainly not the case. Brother Hill.
Yeah, frankly, what was the typical mindset in regard to children mobility? It seems like most children would take on the occupations of their parents.
That's correct.
And, you know, in a sense, the church's view of economics and social life was that all of mankind should be preparing for heaven. They're all Christians.
Right.
You know, was there a sense of guilt about rising, you know, within the mindset of the population and culture, or so that Luther might be, well, his parents might be pushing him very hard to succeed.
Right.
Perhaps there was, that was considered a little socially unacceptable. Is that right or wrong?
Well, let me go back. Social mobility in this day was very limited. You're right. Most people grew up in a particular populace, whether it be rural or city life. They would usually spend their entire lives there, particularly if it was a rural or agricultural area. Most people received a limited education. A quality education was reserved for people with money or people with unusual promise or in some cases with the favor of the church, usually bought. And in Luther's case, it was simply a situation to where his parents sacrificed greatly for him to receive an education. And they couldn't defray all the costs. I mean, I mentioned earlier he's begging for bread at some point. So that Luther can become a person of renown, become a person of reputation and wealth. And the goal in the minds of his parents, and I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, so when I repeat this in the second hour, I act like you didn't hear it in the first. The goal in the minds of his parents is that Luther will become a successful man so that he can, in turn, support them in their old age. That's really their motivation.
So,
right. So when Luther decides he's going to take the tunic of a monk rather than to become a lawyer, suddenly that is not going to happen, is it? Because monks are not wealthy. In fact, monks take a vow, don't they? Yes, a vow of poverty. So you can imagine. His parents have sacrificed all these years to provide him with this education. He finally gets all the way through his university education. He gets to his master's degree. He's ready to go to law school. And now he decides to take a vow of poverty.
Well, his parents were stoking the view. It was not really typical of parents.
Yeah, this, yeah. Basically, as I would understand it, his parents recognized, as did those who educated Luther early, that he was a young man of considerable ability and promise. And his parents, you know, made the decision that they would do whatever was possible to provide him with opportunities to excel. But again, Luther is opening doors, as it were, by his own academic performance. I mean, if he didn't perform well, he would not have escalated through the ranks. So when I say Luther was at the top of his class, there's a real sense in which he needed to be at the top of his class, because he comes from humble origins. So he doesn't have unlimited wealth to provide his education. So he is really under pressure if he's going to fulfill his father's wish to excel academically.
Is there any evidence that he was
a No. No, I don't know of any evidence. I haven't read anything that would indicate what his siblings did in terms of their education at a later time.
Okay.